Welcome to the Azure Podcast, a series of short discussions on various topics related to the Microsoft Cloud Platform. Your hosts, Kale Teeter, Evan Basilek, and Sujit Mello, discuss a specific topic on each show to give you a high-level overview of that topic, and resources to get more information should you wish to dig further. For more information on our show, please see our website at azpodcast.com. Welcome back to the Azure Podcast. This is episode number 164, being recorded on the 2nd of February, 2017, with special guest Kevin Lowe. I'm Sujit, and on Skype with me, I have Evan and our special guest, Kevin. Kale may join us. He seems to be tied up somewhere, so maybe he'll join the fun in a bit. But Evan, thanks for putting all those new items in the show notes. So why don't we get that started first before we turn the mic over to Kevin, okay?
Yeah, sure. A couple of things that I wanted to call out. One of them was the, you know, we internally, we actually run kind of a beta version of the portal, right? So it's, you know, a couple builds ahead of what we expose publicly. And, you know, like everything else, right, the broader we get access, we expose that to people, the more stable it's going to be in the long run. So we've actually now enabled this for customers as well. So if you go to the preview.portal.azure.com, you're going to get the same experience that we're seeing kind of internally as well, a little bit ahead of the regular portal. Now, it's still preview, right? So you may find that you have to drop to the regular portal, or you may find I ran into a bug there myself the other day. But, you know, if you kind of want to always be on the latest and greatest and kind of see where we're going, I definitely recommend people check it out.
And just to be clear, although they're on the preview, what they're doing is real, right?
So it's a preview portal experience. Maybe a better way to say it's a preview portal experience, but the actual resources you're managing are you know, normal stuff.
Yeah.
It's pretty, you know, you're looking at your actual resources. That raises an interesting question. My experience has been that the, you know, we're still calling the same APIs under the covers. So I would, personally, I wouldn't have a whole lot of fear of using it to manage my production resources, but I guess if you are hypersensitive on some workload, you might consider dropping to the regular portal for that particular workload, just in case there's some portal bug there.
Yeah.
I'd hate to find out that something happens and it was because of a bug in the preview portal.
But there are a couple of cool things that are already out there now, right? There's the subscription usage and quotas that you can see now. These are things that are not available in the existing portal. So if you want to try some of these new features and you want to get to them now, you can do them through that preview. The performance is better. So, you know, I know sometimes if you have a lot of these blades open, it takes forever to start up.
Yeah,
the notifications center has been improved, and just, you know, overall accessibility, some theming improvements, and things like that. So they added a lot of features already just to get started, which is nice.
Yep.
And I really like this new update on the DocumentDB. Being able,
I thought that was really cool as well.
ODBC. I thought ODBC was dead, but apparently they figured out a way to connect ODBC to DocumentDB. And I guess the nice thing of having an ODBC driver is there's a million products that work with ODBC drivers, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. ODBC kind of took a lot of hiatus, right? OLEDB was where everything was going to go, and then everybody realized that OLEDB is really hard and really complicated and doesn't give you much over ODBC. But so ODBC still kicking, still strong, but, you know, to your point, right? Yeah. It's, if you got an ODBC driver, almost anybody can use it to call into you.
And so they're talking about connecting it to SQL Server integration services, for example, right? Power BI, Desktop, Tableau, things like that, tools like that, that only know ODBC drivers, right? That's the default driver set that they support. They may not have a native DocumentDB driver, so to speak.
Yep.
And so you could just configure them as if they were a standard ODBC driver.
Yeah, I'm sure there's definitely going to be some, you know, T-SQL limitations and the like, although, you know, Power BI didn't necessarily support everything anyways. But, you know, conceptually, right, you know, if you're just doing standard selects and the like, you're probably going to find really, really good ability here just by having this driver. And you don't have to change your code, right, which is the big thing.
That's the best thing, yeah.
Actually, you can even do deletions and updates. I didn't catch that the first time. That's I might have to go. I might have to go use DocDB now. You know, that might be enough to push me over.
Yeah, especially if you don't, you know, don't want to get bothered with that whole JSON syntax. This might
yeah,
be a
exactly.
way to jump right in.
Yeah, exactly. Leverage some of my leverage existing skills, right?
Yep. And what else we got? Did you see this thing about the Azure Dev Test Labs? They've put a new update on that. So
yeah, I thought that was really cool as well, because now these things, I mean, I don't know about you, but I always go in every so often and I'm like, oh crap, I got, you know, this VM from last week that, you know, even if it's turned off, it's still sitting there and I got to go clean this stuff up.
Right.
I guess we're calling it, you know, basically expiration date, right? Well, they'll auto delete on a certain day. I thought that was pretty, that's almost as good, I think, or I guess it's just as good, but it's a variant of the dev test labs feature that shows up as auto shutdown for these VMs. You know, I'm actually working on something, an ARM template for some ADFS stuff, and I spent like 2 hours on Sunday, I have to admit it, 2 hours trying to figure out why my VM wouldn't join the domain, only to remember that I had an auto shutdown at 11 o'clock the night before. Both my DCs were shut down. it's good. I wasn't getting charged for them anymore. But yeah, you have to remember that if you need them, you have to turn them back on.
Right. And just to be clear, this update, so it was possible to set the expiration in the past. It's just that you had to do it directly in the ARM template. Right. It wasn't surfaced in the portal easily.
Yep.
And so now that's the main update they've made. Is you can just, there's a little property in the portal itself, in the advanced settings, you just go and select a date, and that's it. At that date, that VM is gone.
Right. Yeah. And I mean, a lot of people, right, if you don't put it in the portal UI, it doesn't exist. Yep. Right. I mean, ARM is good, but it's not for everybody. And same with PowerShell and CLI. So.
So do you know anything about this change with the express route coming in? Maybe we can talk about it next time. I saw a note in there saying that
This one's actually, this is something we've kind of been working to already, but starting in March, right, I guess this was probably about a year ago, we enabled the ability to migrate your classic express route circuit to ARM. And then at the same time, at that point, there's a flag you can set that will allow you to do circuit links between that circuit and both classic and ARM VNets at the same time. It's actually the only resource that I can think of that you can directly interact, you know, with both classic and ARM simultaneously, right? With the exception of something like, you know, SQLDB, right, where you can make SQL calls, but it's not really deployed the same way. Mm. And starting in March, right, you're not going to be able to deploy classic circuits anymore. But it's going to be totally transparent, right, because not only is there no change to existing circuits, but any circuit that you deploy can go to both ARM and classic deployments. So it's really going to, you're just not going to be able to create classic express route circuits anymore. So it shouldn't be a huge deal. Obviously, if anybody does have any trouble, right, let us know and we'll figure out what's going wrong.
As always, yeah. Okay, great. Thanks. So again, that's the quick roundup of all the news from this week. And let's get over to our special guest, Kevin. Kevin, thank you very much for joining us this evening. I would appreciate if you could give our listeners a little bit of background and what you do at Microsoft. I know you've been at Microsoft for a long time, so I'm sure you have lots of stories to share, but just give everybody a sense of what you do and what your passion is in the Azure space.
Sure, and thank you guys for inviting me to join the podcast today. I have to say, you guys were talking about ODPC. You were bringing me back to some of my earlier coding days, so good to hear that ODPC is still kicking around. You know?
Yep.
I had a strange idea of connecting access up to Azure in some strange way.
No, that'd be kind of funny, actually. We might have to try that just for fun and see if we can do it.
Yeah, that would be good. That would be good. Yeah, so a little background on myself. So, yes, I have been with Microsoft close to 25 years now. So I've been around for quite a long time. My career started at Microsoft on our direct sales side. So I've been in the New York area residence-wise for most of that time, and so I called on customers directly for probably a good decade or so, from small customers up to some of the largest folks that we've got around here in New Jersey, certainly some of the larger pharmaceutical companies and such. And then 10 years or so, somewhere around there, I switched over to the licensing side within Microsoft. So I work for a group now known as Worldwide Licensing and Pricing, and we help our sales teams work with customers from small to big in terms of acquiring, you know, the products that Microsoft sells to our customers via our volume licensing products. So for some of the folks on the who may be listening to the podcast may be familiar with Microsoft Select, Microsoft Enterprise Agreements, Microsoft Open License, SPLA, which is our service provider license agreement, now transitioning to our cloud service provider agreement, and some more things as we're going to be working on more like direct type volume licensing agreements, you know, down the road. So the group that I specifically work for now, as I've worked for a number of different roles within that group, is an area known as Worldwide Licensing Solutions. And we work with our sales teams, and we liaise back to our marketing groups, our engineering groups, and our senior leadership teams when we want to try to do something that's not necessarily programmatic within our programs. And we've got an interesting, you know, way that we need to be able to sell our products to our customers to best enable them to use our product sets. My group helps our sales teams and our senior leadership and our engineering groups and such to figure out what's the best way to accomplish that with our customers. So Azure, as you can imagine, is one of those key products, you know, that's really starting to grow heavily for us today. And so we're learning a lot, and we're trying to help customers a lot, you know, really take advantage of the great cloud products we've got in the marketplace today.
So can you give it, can you know, I think a lot of people, you know, they maybe have, you know, seen or heard of these, you know, volume license agreements where you can install, you know, you pay X amount and you can install our software that you want. But, you know, when you talk about this in the context of some of these cloud services, what, can you give us an example of kind of what would be a non-typical thing that where somebody would end up coming to your team because they can't do it through normal channels? I mean, what's an example of that?
Sure. Something non-typical would be if you think about the way that we typically a lot of software vendors license products. In the past, it has been largely been like, hey, I want to license something per server. I want to license it per device. You know, the past 5 years or so, we've gotten much more into subscription models in the cloud, and it's been more per user type. Of licensing. On the server side of the house, the cloud, you get into more per core. We work per proc, people have gone to per core, and those are kind of the standard licensing models that kind of exist across the industry. What we're finding is as we get more into the cloud space, especially in Azure, where people are beginning to really move entire data centers to cloud providers across the industry, people are now saying, hey, we're going to be much closer to some of these people's businesses because we're really going to be, you know, tied at the hip running the services. Are there other ways that we could have a great beneficial relationship? So we have started to look at different model sets where it could be, you know, one model is a revenue sharing model where we invest with the customer in a solution for them to help get a product out the door. If that product's successful, we would get a percentage of the revenue for that solution. Another one is classically think about somebody who does the high volume sales of certain product sets. They would want to license maybe by how well their business is doing on those product sets versus the actual, say, compute time that they're using. So maybe they want to do it by how many cars they're selling, how many elevators, you know, they're selling, service rates maybe that they're doing with certain customers, which is much more about their business versus, you know, kind of the compute that they're actually using.
So this sounds a lot then like some of the models you think as the businesses evolve and I can't remember the term for some of this, it escapes me, but like we're basically becoming a partner where if the customer, you know, his product or whatever it is they're selling or creating succeeds, we succeed at that point as well. Rather than kind of a, hey, you give us money and we give you compute and we're done. Right. Type arrangement.
Yeah. And it's, you know, it would be a limited thing. This obviously wouldn't be something that we could do, you know, with all companies. But if there are some interesting ways where it really feels like we're investing with them and there's a really big potential for both us and that customer, we're certainly open to listening to those ideas and seeing how that can work. And that's typically for somebody who's down the road a bit, obviously, in investing with the cloud. You know, normally it's going to be, hey, they're going to start off with doing a trial, you know, using some compute cycles, using some storage cycles, networking, express route, like you guys were talking about. Mm-hmm. Once they've gotten comfortable with the cloud and what it can do, and they feel good about how the data is secure, encrypted, those type of things, then you start to get into those larger business relationships where they feel good about, okay, yeah, you know what, I can use you as my data center, and now I want to give you more of my business, and let's think of other ways that we can do this long term.
Yeah, that makes sense, because I guess really the pay-as-you-go model where you're paying per compute really starts falling down a little bit as you start talking big workloads.
Yeah, it's, you know, and that's the thing with our volume licensing programs, we give you a lot of flexibility. You know, you can give us, you can do pay-as-you-go, you know, and just we'll bill you in arrears for the, you know, for the uses that you have. You can also, if your budget allows for it or is better for your budget, you can do a monetary commitment. So you could give us money up front and then burn that money down over time, or you could do obviously a combo of both for those. So we try to be flexible in that, and then yeah, certainly as the workloads get bigger, or maybe it gets a little more interesting, you know, no surprise, you know, we're humans, we like to think of interesting ways to do things, and customers do too, and so we try to figure out if there's beneficial ways to make that work for both companies.
Now, Kevin, how much does the competitive nature of cloud computing factor into your work and what you know kind of decisions that you make? I'm sure you guys, you know, come across AWS and others vendors a lot in your discussions. How does that factor in?
Yeah, that's a key component of what of the marketplace these days. And you know, in so many respects, it's a great marketplace for companies. Because it is such a competitive, vibrant market these days. You have, obviously, you know, we've got a tremendous Azure business that's growing quite steadily, as you saw from our latest earnings report, mm-hmm. Office 365. But you also see very strong growth from, you know, competitors like AWS, who have, you know, probably the leading cloud in terms of size, you know, and in that space. Google is constantly, you know, kind of improving their product set for sure. IBM is doing the same. So, yeah, we get into this fairly often, and a lot of that comes when, as you start to, people start to take a look at the clouds, they really do a strong comparison between the clouds and really want to understand, are you meeting the needs that I have? Now, you know, the nice thing for working for Microsoft is we're very focused on trust, you know, security and privacy. So that's really where we tend to really want to lead in the marketplaces around those areas. So trust for sure. You know, a lot of people may have seen some of the things where we're really fighting for our customers in terms of, you know, protecting their data and making sure that, you know, their data is secure
right,
within the
right.
Microsoft environment, and really, you know, working with the industry to make sure that there's strong standards. You know, when it comes to our cloud, it's nice to be able to say that, hey, we have more certifications, you know, than any cloud provider. So as we're talking to people and they're comparing our stuff, you know, we have the ISO standard, CSA, ITAR, CJIS, which is a criminal justice standard. We have HIPAA, you know, for the healthcare environments, and IRS 1075. So we have a number of different certifications that really help our customers understand that we're very committed to their business and many industries across the marketplace. And it really gives them a good feeling about the cloud itself. And then certainly security and privacy. And we detail all of this. You know, all of this is public. You can go to our trust center on the web, and you'll see all of this information publicly displayed and publicly put out for people to see. So it's not hidden from our customers. We try to be very upfront about the great work that we do with the cloud, so they can feel really good about bringing their customer data over to our clouds.
Yeah, it's funny you talk about the certifications. You know, I see some of these announcements coming out, and I just heard a new one in there that I think you said it was CJIS, some justice
yes.
certificate. Like there's new ones every time I turn around. There's another one. I mean, every industry seems to have their own, and but you're right. It's a huge challenge to make sure for these customers that whatever vendor they're using has these, and we put a lot of effort into that.
It is. It's a lot of effort. It's not just, you know, it's not just a marketing effort. It's real engineering effort and mm-hmm. many, you know, as you can imagine, many millions of dollars to build the standards into the product set itself. Yeah, so CJIS is the Criminal Justice Information System. So think about the cameras that the police officers are wearing now and, you know, in many locales. All that data that they get all has to be stored and has to be stored in a way so that it complies with the CJIS system is what the FBI uses and many of the federal agencies in order to access that data and make sure it's being accessed, you know, by the right folks. So, you know, we spent a good deal of money, and I used to work and help support the public sector business for Microsoft, so that's why I know a little bit about this. And that's a really big thing for us, where we have that, and so we can work with local police departments and big police departments across the country, and they know that their data will meet those standards, and it's going to be secure for their, you know, for their environments.
Well, not to mention the sovereign cloud and Azure government, right? For if you happen to be in the U.S. or you know, we've got one in Germany, and then I guess we're standing up some in South Korea and the such, right? For similar things, because you know, some of these things you're talking about, these certifications are, this is not just, you know, U.S. stuff. This is worldwide.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. So we do. We have the sovereign cloud here in the U.S. for the government. What we would call GCC, our government community cloud. We're starting the one up in Germany as well, and then I think Korea is also going to be a sovereign cloud. I know Australia is a sovereign cloud, though that may have just got opened up a little bit. And yeah, then we're always opening up new regions. We actually have 32 regions today, with 6 more announced as well. So we have the most regions as well of any cloud provider in the marketplace today as well. So we're investing. We invested in Canada not too long ago, so we've got 2 DCs up in Canada, France is coming online, Germany. So we're really making sure that customers can feel good as best we can that their data will reside within a given country, and that when need be, we can meet the local laws in those countries as well.
So Kevin, you know, one of the things that I'd like to find out is, when you work, I've done business, some of my customers have been large customers, and they typically have this thing called an enterprise agreement, right? Which is this big agreement, they span over multiple years, and they license a whole bunch of things. And now that company wants to move to the cloud, right? Is there something special that they need to do to take all those assets and move into the cloud from a licensing perspective? Is there something special that goes on, or is it just a matter of, it doesn't really matter if it's running on-premises or in the cloud, it's the same thing? What's the difference there?
Yeah, I don't know if I would call it special, but I think there's a good amount of due diligence that customers really need to do. We have a process that our sales teams work with customers on, known as the Cloud Decision Framework. Or CDF, everything needs to have a three-letter acronym.
Of course.
and so what that really does is it really walks people through how we run our cloud. And this, like we've been talking about, some of the standards and such, because that's going to be super important for customers. So, you know, if you're on-premises today, you're running your cloud yourself. It's on-prem. You know how everything works. You're running that physical location. Who's in there? Who's got the access? When you want to go to Microsoft Cloud or really any hyperscale cloud provider, those questions are now going to come up. And so as an IT organization, if that's, say, who's in charge of the data center set, you're going to now need to bring in more than just probably the normal groups that you've had. You're probably going to need to start to bring in some client compliance people, privacy, security, certainly some legal, because as you pick up your data and want to move it over to our cloud, you're going to probably start to encounter and say, hey, how do you guys do X? Mm. You know, subcontractors, is the data at rest all the time? How does my data in transit? Is it encrypted? Is it not encrypted? Where might my data go? You know, if your data center fills up and you need to buffer the data, is it always going to stay in the U.S. or is it going to go to a data center somewhere else and then maybe come back when, you know, your capacity's back again? And so all these questions that kind of pop up, customers really need to start to go through this process so they can really understand how each of the providers does their work. And we have plenty of people, you know, locally and obviously, you know, in our corporate world who can help customers go through that process and really feel comfortable about that. From an EA perspective, you know, the enterprise agreement perspective, the key piece that you're going to really see there is a document that we call the Online Services Terms and Conditions, or OST. That we would call it. And that's a document, again, all of this is public, that goes through in details what are the security, what are the privacy actions that Microsoft commits to in running the cloud. And so that's going to be a key thing for customers to kind of get familiar with so they can really understand what are the commitments Microsoft's making, service level agreements, those type of things. So when I bring my data over, I can feel really good and really strong about what's happening you know, with the cloud that I decide I want to use.
Right, and this is something that they have to sign, right? Eventually, or the.
Yes, absolutely. It's part of the base agreements, and so if they have an enterprise agreement, there probably isn't a customer today who doesn't really have online services.
Right, because they're probably using O365 or something, some other online component.
Correct. You're going to have that, and it's something that has to be in place between both parties because it's super important for both parties to really have a way of saying how are we going to work together in this environment. In the on-premises world, it was a little bit less of a need per se. We wrote some great code, we gave you some great stuff, but then the customers ran it themselves, so we didn't really get involved in terms of, hey, where does the data rest and all that, because it was always with the customer. Now that we're running those services for customers and helping them do things in a very efficient way, those questions come back to Microsoft. So people want to understand what are the commitments that we make in those areas, and that's what all the documentation will tell our customers.
Yeah, and we have, you know, Sajid, we have all this all these great agreements that Kevin is helping our customers sign, or why, you know, you and I every time we turn around are having to do multi-factor authentication for, you know, all of our access and all of our you know, access to all of our resources internally. And I even hit another level of that when I'm actually troubleshooting Azure stuff, right? Because there's some places, some pieces of data that I can only get by using multi-factor to get to this jump box that's over here, and the jump box only has certain access and certain control. And it really is, you know, I go back 8-10 years ago when I started in this space, and I was like, oh yeah, it's accessible from anywhere in CorpNet and like, and now, I mean, you've seen over the years all that stuff tightened down to meet all these requirements that our customers have to meet and that ultimately we have to meet for them now, when to Kevin's point, right, previously they just had to manage it themselves and we didn't have to worry about it.
And we're learning a lot, you know, as we get into certain areas. I'm in the New York area, so you can imagine the financial services space, you know, some of the laws and regulations and stuff that they need to adhere to, you know, as a globally strategic important financial institution, are fairly stringent and fairly strong. And so even at Microsoft, as we get into the space, we learn more and more, and we keep updating, you know, our standards and stuff to meet the capabilities of these super complex, you know, multinational corporations. And the interesting thing about this, I think, that many companies don't realize is how invested Microsoft is in security, in terms of not just like encryption and this, but also just as a security vendor. So where we have products like advanced threat protection and those type of things, Exchange Online protection, people don't realize like the cybersecurity resources that Microsoft has and that we bring, you know, to the internet every day and work with the industry. We're really actually probably one of the underdog security providers, I would say, in the marketplace today. People don't really think of us when they think of a security provider. They don't think of Microsoft. But when you see our dark rooms and the things that we do to run our data centers and what we're opening up to customers, it's really actually fairly impressive. I think it's an area where customers are starting to look at us more for, wow, we didn't realize Microsoft was in this space. And it's an area you can actually provide a lot of value back to customers.
I mean, it's one of those areas where we're looking out for our customers helps us look out for ourselves and vice versa, right? Because we're a huge, just like some of the other cloud providers, right? We're a pretty huge target. Right, so we have to be crisp on that stuff, and it's really about letting customers benefit from that knowledge and expertise, and sometimes, you know, hard learned lessons as we go along.
Yep. I mean, we, you know, Windows Defender now as part of Windows 10 is a really serious, you know, antivirus, you know, product set these days, and the data we gather for that helps us just keep continually to build and build. Really great product set. So it's amazing to see that as the progress the company's making in that space.
Now, Kevin, let's suppose a company wants to, you know, they're doing a lot of on-premises work and they want to move to the cloud. What are some best practices that you can suggest to them to, you know, approach it from a cost licensing perspective? Like, how might they get the best bang for the buck, for example?
Yeah, I think they need to really decide. You know, the first thing you probably want to decide is what are the workloads you first want to move over to the cloud. A lot of customers will look to do dev test, you know, as a first environment where they can really begin to, because that's the kind of environment that you're not putting it up and running it constantly, and you're going to run it for a long period of time. You're going to put it up and take it down, put it down, put it up, take it down. And so the cloud environments really help for that. really allow for that flexibility. And, you know, with per minute billing, a bunch of different virtual type machines, you know, that customers can use, whether it's like a general VM or a high performance VM or something that's compute specific or more storage specific. It really allows in a dev test environment, you can really kind of test a bunch of those things out and really get a feel for the cloud. So it's a good first kind of environment in which to kind of test out some workloads in that way. You know, when they feel comfortable, then obviously they can start to do it if they want to. They could do a trial, or they can really kind of start to just go right to the web and begin using Azure. We recently have done a number of things with our pricing and such so that the pricing you see when you go to Azure.com, that's the same level of pricing that you'll see in our volume licensing agreements as well. So what we don't want to have, what we want to make sure customers are able to see when they go to the web is they feel good about the pricing they see and make sure that that's a price. And if they're going to compare that, you know, to another provider, maybe it's Google, maybe it's AWS, they can do the comparisons from there as well. Certainly, if they're one of our larger customers, they can obviously work with their, you know, their corporate account teams and such. And we can look at if they want to make, you know, a super large investment, like many things, we can look at, you know, helping them with some of those investments and maybe in terms of pricing and other resourcing that they may need on those agreements themselves. But really the key is to figure out what are those first workloads, you know, you really want to start off with and really then look and say, all right, what are the capabilities within each of the cloud providers who can add value into those environments themselves.
Great. And I suppose in parallel, they would also have the discussion with the security and the compliance and everything, right? Yeah, kind of get that going in parallel.
Exactly. And that's why a lot of folks start with dev test, because it's not production data.
Right.
You know, and so it's not their customer data up. It's they're testing out things and that type of stuff. And so they can get a feel for how the different cloud sets work, while they can also in parallel get their security, their compliance folks, privacy folks involved to say, hey, we're thinking about taking this data set, which has this customer data, which could be low, medium, high, you know, security-wise, are we okay with bringing that, you know, to the cloud?
What's been some of the biggest blockers that you've experienced so far? I mean, I'm sure you've spoken to a number of big customers and over time. Are there any kind of general blockers that you see out there and things that, you know, might inhibit a customer to move to the cloud?
I think the things that you see, I mean, it ranges from different things. One is certainly there are some technical blockers. You know, the clouds are always improving.
Sure.
But customers may be looking to try to do X, Y, and Z. And so certainly, you know, each of the cloud has its own idiosyncrasies. And so they may run across, a technical blocker per se. And they can certainly work with our teams to help identify that and get back to our engineering folks and see if, you know, see something can be done in that sense. But we generally don't find that too often. I mean, the good thing about Microsoft is we've always been kind of diligent in perseverance when it comes to our product sets. So we're constantly updating those, as you guys were mentioning, at the beginning of the podcast and such. So that's always a great thing. Certainly, you know, I've seen people have blockers around not thinking through like a cloud decision type of framework. And so they get excited about wanting to do it, and then they run into their own internal process, which slows them down because they have to go get the checkboxes, you know, internally and such. And so that's why I always encourage customers to, you know, think about that and think about that up front, because it's super important, especially when your customer data, you want to move it and host it in a cloud. People are going to want to feel good and feel comfortable that the data is secure in that sense. And then other blockers. I'm not, you know, it's really more of those two are the biggest ones that I really see where, and it's more of industry specific types of things where you may have in financial services, they have certain things they want to be able to do, and certain clouds may not be up to speed on those yet. Or it may be like healthcare, where you have certain things you can imagine in healthcare. Right. You know, with a lot of the personally identifiable information and such, you need to make sure that the clouds are quite secure and they have to meet HIPAA standards in other areas. And so sometimes they can be blockers in that type of sense. And again, we've done a lot of work in these industries, so if customers have questions about this, they should certainly feel free to reach out to Microsoft. We're more than happy to kind of give them a very transparent, like, here's where we are, here's where we're not, and here's what our roadmap is.
It sounds like at this point, this is one of the benefits kind of to the scale that we're operating at these days, right? That the odds of, customer XYZ from industry ABC, the odds of that industry being under some requirement that is nowhere near being covered gets less all the time, right? Because there's somebody else probably has been there and has kind of thought through that, and we've looked at that.
Yes, absolutely.
But I'm sure there's always more somewhere, but.
Yes, and, an example of that. So, yeah, that's absolutely, which is why we're focused. We've always been a very developer engineering focused company, which is why we're, we want to have those standards because that's the way we've always thought. But even like legal standards. So there's a new one that's coming in Europe known as GDPR, the General Data Protection, I forget the word now, thing. And it's coming in May 2018 to replace some of the European law that's in place today. And so we have to have obviously a number of legal experts look at that, but we also have to work quite hard from an engineering perspective to make sure that when that law is in place, we can say to our customers confidently, yes, we meet the GDPR standards going forward. So there's always, like you said, always new things popping up, and we're constantly looking at that and updating the clouds to meet those standards.
Kevin, I want to ask you just a quick pricing question before we wrap up over here. So, this is not something that's publicly known, then we don't have to talk about it. But, I always get fascinated that, the price that's shown, the compute price that's shown, like, say, if you go into one particular region in one country, and then if I go to Brazil, for example, I see a different price over there, right? I mean, what are some of the factors that cause this price variance other than currency differences? Is there something that we publicly discuss as to why these prices are different between these countries?
Yeah, and it's a good question, and you are absolutely correct. And you will see that across the different data centers that, the pricing, and it may even happen within the U.S. itself, that, hey, U.S. East data center for a given compute workload or GPU or storage stuff may be different than, say, U.S. West. And that happens due to capacity. We may have capacity that has suddenly freed up, and so we know our customers are constantly kind of looking at the portal and understanding where the pricing is, and we may say, oh, look, we've got more capacity in East now because of becoming more efficient, a customer moved to the West, maybe something like that. So we'll price the capacity in the East a little bit less. So as customers are looking about where do I want to deploy a workload to, they can take advantage of that price as part of that. So, yeah, we do see that. Certainly FX, foreign exchange comes into play. Microsoft does look forward in terms of FX pricing, and so we'll set pricing across the world based on where we think, some of the FX rates are going. And so that'll affect that, hey, one price in Brazil may look, even on a currently translation basis, it may look different than what's in the U.S. It may look different than what's in Germany. And that's kind of natural. That would be happening, I think, across the industry as well in those cases. So, there's no secret sauce, per se, on that, but it's more looking at, are we gaining efficiencies in those different areas? And if we are, or we have some extra capacity, those type of things, we will adjust prices to help customers get better utilization, but also for us. We want to have, high utilization allows us to be most efficient. So
right.
If one data center's got some capacity, we may lower the price on that a bit for a little bit of time to get more capacity moving over there and be able to run our clouds more efficiently.
Don't worry, Sujeet. I promise that I won't call in some favors with some devs in the portal and see if I can get your prices bumped up for you
specifically. No, every time I create a new resource, right, it sometimes just defaults me to the Brazil data center, right, region. And I don't know if that's because of capacity or because of price. Like, is it trying to give me the benefit of price by putting them there, or is that where there's more capacity? Like, I would expect them to drop me to East 2, which is where I normally go. So I always wonder, like, how it makes those kind of decisions. But that's just me being curious.
yeah, and me as well. I can't say I know when you start a new, start a new tenant and start a new resource, why it picks, say, Brazil over East. I would guess it's less about price and more about Capacity,
yes. So it's, yeah. it's a supply.
You may also have it if you're doing this from home. We have seen in the past that IP addresses that have moved around the world, they may be geolocated in the wrong place versus where they are.
I think some in South America.
Yeah, we had a but we had a bug for a while where we moved some IPs from the U.S. to Brazil, and for the longest time we kept getting calls from our Brazil customers, you know, going, why are you putting my traffic through the U.S.? You know, I'm paying on. No, it's not. It's just the geo database is not right. We're, you know, we're trying to fix it. So that might be the other thing as well.
Okay, excellent. Well, this has been a great discussion. Evan, is there anything else we have for Kevin?
No, this is, I learned a lot here. Like I said, you know, when we were getting ready to come in, I mean, I talk technical about Azure all day long and have for years, but, you know, the whole aspect of actually, you know, how customers, you know, pay for it and sign up for it and stuff is kind of a new area to me. So, no, yeah, thank you very much for coming on, Kevin.
Sure. It'd be great to, I mean, happy to come back as we, you know, this always kind of continues and evolves over time. So
We'll get you back in May. What would you say, May of 2018? You can let us know how the
GDPR.
GDPR is going.
Yeah, exactly. Well, that's going to affect the whole world because it's, you know, any time a multinational person is over in Europe, there's going to be an expectation that, you know, you're meeting those GDPR standards. So,
right.
You know, when the Europeans say, hey, we, you know, and, you know, Europe is very strong on privacy. And so they're actually leading the world in a lot of cases. On a lot of this, and obviously the vendors work quite hard just to keep pace. So, but it's good. That's why it's great for consumers, great for enterprises, because it's a very vibrant industry, and so they're gaining the benefit of this very competitive marketplace. You know, you've seen pricing, you know, go down over the years and such. So it's super great for enterprises as well, and we're super excited to work with our customers.
Agreed. Thank you very much.
Thanks a lot, Kevin. Really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the show. If you have any comments or questions, please use our Twitter handle at Azure Podcasts. Background music has been taken from ccmixter.org under the Creative Commons license. Thank you, and see you next time.